The subject of the talk tonight is fear and fearlessness. Fear is one of the deepest and most powerful conditionings in our heart and mind. It's very ancient. It's very primal. It seems to be shared by most living creatures and humans. And when it's present as a force in our life, it acts as a kind of cloud that casts a shadow and keeps the sunlight, the bright sunlight, out of our heart and out of our life. Limits our ability to enjoy and open to the beauty that life presents. Limits our ability to connect to one another. This was pointed to in the title of a very popular book by a California psychiatrist named Gerald Jampolsky, whose book was titled Love is Letting Go of Fear, with the idea that when we can let go of this force, love just flows naturally from us. It's a difficult emotion to be with. When it arises, it's usually not one that we greet with a lot of happiness and joy. It's quite challenging to experience, and we often experience it very directly in meditation. And until we learn to work with it, if it comes up in a strong way, the force of fear can feel overwhelming, confusing, can feel like we're lost in it, and in our general life it can lead to unskillful choices and actions that we later might regret a lot. But because it is such a difficult force in the heart and mind, it also presents the opportunity in meditation for us to find a great deal of added freedom in our life. So wherever we are experiencing obstacles in practice, that points to the possibility of really enlarging the scope of our ease and peace and freedom in the world. And fear is one of those areas where we can really bring the tools of the Dharma, the tools of meditation practice, and open up in a big way. So in the near term, our aim in practice is not to get rid of this experience of fear. I believe it is in the long term. I think it's one of the possibilities of awakening that this force can be completely uprooted from the mind. But in the near term, we don't need to aim that far to gain a lot of freedom around it. So what we want to find is, how can we develop a relationship with fear that's not conditioned by fear itself, by dislike, by confusion and unsettledness? So in the talk tonight, I really want to look at fear from a few different angles and explore it from Dharma points of view. So to start with, I just want us all to take a look at our kind of our basic situation in very existential terms. The basic property of being a human being is that we have six functioning senses through which different kinds of contacts at those six sense doors are constantly coming to us. And our life consists of these impacts, and the nature of this stream of contact is such that it alternates being pleasurable, being painful, and being neither pleasurable nor painful. These qualities, pleasure, pain, and neither, are so important, as I think Greg said, that the Buddha devoted a whole foundation of mindfulness to them, the mindfulness of feeling tone, or Vedana. Moreover, we don't really have control over the sequence of these contacts and their pleasurable or unpleasant nature. We're at the mercy of our sense doors. So whether one is awakened or whether one is not, the contacts of pleasure and pain continue to strike us. And especially when we're young and growing up and don't really understand the nature of sense contact, this ongoing, you might say, assault of the senses creates for us a sense of insecurity in life. We don't have a way to protect ourselves against the changing situations of life. And that is, as I see it, the root of human confusion. So fear is one way we respond to the painful aspects of this fundamental insecurity. And in fact, I think that all the kilesas are various strategies of dealing with this uncertainty. So we can take the three kilesas of greed, hatred, and delusion, and I think that each of them is a way to try to deal with this uncontrollable alternation of pleasure and pain. So what the greed tries to do is to reach out and pull in the pleasant to us again and again so that the stream becomes as constantly pleasurable as possible. That's the activity of desire or greed. What hatred tries to do is to keep away from us any contact with the painful or unpleasant. And I think hatred actually has two modes. One I would call an aggressive mode, and the other I would call a recoiling mode. So the aggressive mode is more the movement of anger that seeks to push away what is threatening with force. And the recoiling mode is more the activity of fear that tries to draw back from the contact with the unpleasant. But both anger and fear are different ways of trying to avoid the painful contact. And delusion is a strategy whose purpose is to develop some kind of cloud or distance or barrier so that these contacts don't assault us so intensely. So in a way, you could say we space out with delusion in order not to feel closely the naked experience of sense contact. So I think something interesting about all three of these kilesas is that they're all volitional. Each one has a purpose, and its purpose is to protect us in some way, to keep the pleasant coming, to push away the unpleasant, or to not feel the mixture of pleasant and unpleasant. So we can start to tune into these acts as intentional actions. This is the factor of chetana that James, I think, introduced in the meditation the other morning. So fear is one of these strategies, and what fear does is to imagine something painful that's going to happen in the future and then figure out how we can not experience it. That's its basic motivation or intention. But you'll notice that fear is really closely related to desire, because as soon as we say, I don't want this to happen, at the same time we're saying, I want something else to happen instead of that. So I want this outcome and I don't want this outcome, which I'm afraid of. So fear is very coupled with desire. So you could say that as soon as we fear a certain experience, we hope for a different experience. And in addition, when we hope for something or want something, it comes with the fear of not getting it. You can notice this in something you really want, a specific job, specific amount of income, a specific partner, a certain outcome at work. As soon as we fasten on to that outcome with strong desire, there's a fear underneath of not getting it. So these two are very closely linked, and the Tibetans use the two together, called hope and fear, as a way of explaining the basic neurotic tendency to try to control what's really uncontrollable. They'll just use hope and fear as a shorthand for all the three kilesas operating together. So, as we look at the qualities of desire and fear and how closely linked they are, we often see that we want to give up fear, but not many of us want to give up desire. And yet, because they're so closely linked, the Dharma really asks us to give up both. That's the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And I think another interesting question is, with desire and fear, which is more fundamental? Did we come into this world, a kind of a blank slate, and then feel the changing nature, the alternation of pleasure and pain, and seek to find some relief from that through the operation of fear? Is that really the most fundamental? We realize we're vulnerable. We realize that we may die. You know, when that starts to dawn on the child, that's an important moment in the development of the person. Do we really feel that underlying threat to our survival and our well-being as the fundamental motivating force, and then seek to bring pleasure in to offset it, to give some security? Or do we come into life looking for pleasure, and in the frustration of it, get scared we're not going to be able to find it? So the Buddha, in the teaching on the Second Noble Truth, pointing to craving as the cause of suffering, I think pointed to desire as being more fundamental. Remember when Carol talked about the Second Noble Truth, she used that quote, finding delight now here, now there, as the basic motive force that leads to suffering. So I think in the Buddhist terms, desire is more primary. That's just one man's opinion. You know, we all have to look for ourselves. For a fear type, the other answer seems really obvious. So let me talk a little about the personality types. You've probably heard of these, but just to make sure that everybody has. In Buddhist psychology, people can be classified in personalities depending on which of the three kilesas is predominant in them. We all have all three, but if you look around at yourself and family members and friends and those you know, you might see that some people respond more from desire, some respond more from aversion, some respond more from confusion or delusion. And if that's really clear in somebody, we might say that's their personality type. That individual is governed more by the force of greed or aversion or delusion. So there are these three personality types describing the unripened qualities of mind. So we talk about people as being greed types, aversion types, or delusion types. Remembering that we all have all three, all classifications are tentative, and we don't classify other people for them. We allow people to self-select, please. So again, in the aversive type, I think there are two aversive temperaments. One is the aggressive, angry temperament, and the other is the pulling back, fearful temperament. So I think we can make that division. So my self-confessed type is the pulling back aversive. When I look back over my life and even into my early years, I see that my mind and actions have been governed more by that fear force than by either desire or anger or delusion. So, as a fear type of the personality types, it just seems to me obvious that fear is the most fundamental movement. You know, what would any reasonable person do otherwise in this insecure existence that we find ourselves in? It really seems to me like the only reasonable response a person can make to the uncertainty of life. But that's what's been interesting about being married for close to 30 years now to someone who's of a different personality type. My wife, Sally, whom many of you know, is not a fear type. And so I've learned a lot about my personality through living with her because she doesn't have that trait so predominantly. She's what I'd call a more sanguine personality type. She's more easygoing. She has an aversive side also, which she will self-confess. But it's not particularly about fear. So, for instance, I see it when we travel together. We often teach together at different centers around the country, so we're often flying together. And you know what a pleasure it is to fly these days, right? Many of you experience that delight in coming here. So, you know, we're packing, getting ready for the airport. Maybe a taxi is coming to get us, to take us to the airport. And I start worrying. I start worrying, is the taxi going to come on time? And then maybe the taxi comes on time, we get to the airport on time. I start worrying, are we going to get through security on time? Because, you know, they basically do a strip search these days. And by the time you get through, you could spend a long time there. And then I think, oh, if we're flying to another city and we're going to make a connection, we might be late. Maybe we're going to miss our connection. And even if we make the connection, I think, well, the person who's going to pick us up at the other end is going to forget about us. And, of course, all these things have happened at different times, but they don't usually happen all together. Nonetheless, that's kind of the way my mind goes. And, of course, I feel obliged to share these reflections with my wife. And I can just see her getting more and more exasperated, like, why do you have to think of everything that could go wrong here for us? And I go, well, I'm just trying to help. So you sort of see this worrying temperament is trying to find the safest way through life. But as we do that, us worry types, we don't really notice the impact on the here and now. We don't notice that this thread of concern, anxiety, worry about the future is having an unsettled, contracted, fearful kind of impact on our mind and body in the present moment. Once we tune into that, we start to see this really isn't a very optimal way to live. And this is just one of the one of the manifestations of this tendency. You probably know this joke. There's a patient who goes to see a therapist in Manhattan. And as soon as the patient sits down, they start snapping their fingers. And they have a normal conversation for a while, but after a while the therapist goes, I know you're snapping your fingers very frequently. Why are you doing that? And the patient says, that's to keep the elephants away. And the therapist says, but there are no elephants in Manhattan. And the patient says, yeah, it really works, doesn't it? So this is what a fear type thinks about their worry. It's serving to keep things on track as best they know how. But just like the patient, it's magical thinking. And it's not really needed. Because the uncertainty of our life situation is true. The truth of anicca, dukkha, anatta is clear. The alternation of pleasant and unpleasant experiences is really clear. That's true. That's not going to change. But then the question it raises is, does it mean knowing that we have to respond with fear of what could happen? And fortunately, the answer is no. And this is one of the great things we learn about meditation. Our response to life doesn't have to be conditioned by outside situations and changing events or from our own mental habits. And this is such a big and great understanding. Our mind doesn't have to be determined by either outside events or our own habits of conditioning. When we really start to get that, this whole world of possibilities opens up. So this started to dawn for me. I was meditating on a retreat in England. I did a lot of practice in England in my early years. I was connected with a teacher from there. And I would go and practice at this place that was the precursor to Gaia House. Before they bought Gaia House, the group had rented a little residence in Wiltshire and ran retreats there. So I would go there in the summer to do extended periods of practice. So this was a summer retreat. I was there for 2 months. And it was in between, sometime between tea and the Dharma talk. And I'd gone out to stand. The back garden of this house was quite lovely. It was on the edge of a village in the countryside, and there was a very grassy back garden, and looked onto rolling hills beyond. And in the back garden, there were plants and flowers, and there was a fruit tree that was also flowering. It was early summer. So I was doing standing meditation right by the fruit tree. My eyes were closed. And for whatever reason, I can't remember now, I was in some kind of fear state. So I was standing there in meditation, experiencing the fear, and I knew enough about practice to open to it and feel it. So I was just feeling it in my body, feeling it as a mood. And then for some reason, I opened my eyes. And when I opened my eyes, I got this immediate hit of the soft English summer evening that it was. And if you've ever been in England on a soft summer evening, there's nothing like it. There's kind of like this velvety peace that is that, the texture of that landscape. The sun was going down, so the garden was filled with this golden light of the setting sun. I was standing next to the tree, maybe it was an apple tree, that was in full flower. The morning doves were calling. You know that sound they always put into the soundtrack of Downton Abbey? It evokes rural England. So it's in every British kind of masterpiece theater that you watch. And I opened my eyes and I felt all that come in and I thought, wow, it's really a scary world, isn't it? The contrast was just so striking. My inner landscape was totally not connected to the safety and beauty of the present moment that I was actually living in. And it just revealed what a fabrication the whole complex of fear was, how unconnected it was to reality, and how much unnecessary suffering there was in it. So it was really an insight for me to see the emotion was real, but the thoughts about it being based on any kind of reality was not. It was just an imagination, that whole construction of fear. So I started looking into the causes of fear, and you know, fear comes from a lot of different sources. So I'll talk a little bit about the things that fear originates from. I think one of the helpful insights was expressed really clearly by Krishnamurti, who's an Indian philosopher, no longer alive. And he put it very simply when he said, thought breeds fear. Thought breeds fear. So when we think about the future, when we imagine something that could be difficult in the future, that thought generates the emotion of fear in the mind. Don't think the thought, don't have the fear. That's often the way that it works. Mark Twain said, "I'm an old man and have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened." Spoken like a true fear type. And in the tradition of Chan Buddhism from China, there's this story about an artist who's painting a picture of a tiger. You know, using those big, bold brush strokes that the Zen artists use. And, you know, he slashes away at the scroll, and this magnificent dynamic animal starts to emerge from his bold brush strokes, and he finishes the painting. It's done rather quickly. Then he steps back and he goes, "Ah, a tiger!" Because he's frightened by his own creation. And it's just a creation. It's just a fabrication. But that's what we do with our thoughts. We scare ourselves. We don't have to think them, and we don't have to make up the images. This is part of the beauty of the mind's calming. As the mind calms through this process of samatha, of tranquility, of growing the factor of enlightenment, of calm, not so many of those scary thoughts have to get generated, and we find ourselves more in balance through not assailing ourselves with those. And we start to realize that if we don't stir things up with our fearful thinking, there is an underlying peace that kind of holds us. And this is also a really important insight, that we start to trust that if we don't stir up the mind and we just let it settle as it is, its natural state is peace. So we sort of learn that really what we want to do is let things be as they are and not try to concoct anything different through our imagination or through our willpower. And that, you know, that's the receptive power of our Vipassana practice. We learn more and more to let things be and not try and shape them, concoct them, construct them, fashion them in a particular constructed way. So this is one of the main sources of thought, of fear, is that we think scary thoughts. But there's another source that's really important, especially for meditators, and that is that as we've gone through life, we have, all of us have been assaulted by events and forces and emotions that were too much for us to handle in our state at that time, in our younger state, less wise state, more sensitive state, more vulnerable state. When we aren't able to fully process an event in life, a difficult event, it tends to get lodged in the body as stored tension, and in that tension gets stored the emotion that we weren't able to open to, along with the tension. So there are many kinds of events that do this kind of thing. Abuse of a child, physical, emotional, or sexual, can have this kind of effect. A child's losing its connection with its mother or father at an early age can lead to a feeling of abandonment that can't be opened to. The pervasive effect of racism in this society leaves an impact of, we might say, a sense of exclusion or assault on many people of color that is stored in the body and whose emotions are stored in the mind. A jarring accident or some kind of violence that happens, even if it's something as innocent as a car crash, can bring up feelings of fear or terror that we may not be able to open to and therefore get lodged in the body and lodged in the mind. When we come into meditation practice, we turn our attention to the present moment and we let things just settle on their own. That opens a doorway, that silence and space opens the doorway for the body and the mind to tell us what they're holding. So we'll find that as we move into the spaciousness of a silent meditation retreat, especially a longer one like this, that the body and mind want to bring their contents up into consciousness. For the heart and mind, these things have been repressed, the memory has been repressed, and so the mind and heart want to try to release them. And there's this movement to re-experience them again in the attempt to heal, to move through them. The body will express it through releases of the stored tension, which come across sometimes as very strong energy releases, sometimes strong holding. Just the experience of strong pain, of tension. People often report feeling a strong constriction around the heart or in the neck or in the back. Instances of things that may have been held for a long time. And the beauty of our mindfulness practice is that if we're willing to open and feel these things, they move through. They have always wanted to move through, but we didn't know how to hold them earlier. Now we're learning how to hold them and feel them, and that's what they're asking for. That's all we have to do, is let ourselves feel them and open to them with some degree of kindness, acceptance, compassion, etc. And when we can do that, they have the space to breathe, and like all states of mind and body, all they want to do is demonstrate their impermanence. That's all they've wanted to do from the beginning. Arise be recognized, be felt, and pass through. But because we couldn't let them pass through, they got frozen in us. Now we have the wisdom, and meditation gives us a stability of mind to hold what's so difficult. Then they can really pass through. And honestly, some of these things pass through, and then they're just gone. They're gone as though they'd never been there before. That's the extent of the release and the extent of the healing that's possible through this practice of mindfulness. So, we may feel it's a disaster in place when these things come up, but actually it's a direct road to greater and greater freedom, because they can't be released until they're felt. They're asking for our attention. We need to give our attention. So one of the other kinds of fear is the fear of death. This is one that seems to be shared among most living creatures. Animals certainly have it. Most humans have it. And yet it's interesting, when they did a survey a few years ago of what people were most afraid of, the fear of death came in at number 4. And number 1 on people's list was a fear of speaking in public. Isn't that wild? Personally, I'd rather be doing this tonight than dying, but other people could feel differently. I love this title. Ajahn Amaro gave a talk one time. He's the abbot of Amravati Monastery in England. He gave a talk one time titled, "Why Public Speaking is More Terrifying Than Worldwide Nuclear Destruction," which is further down on the list than public speaking. So, of course, around the fear of dying, some of the fear we understand has a rational basis, right? Like, there's a fear of pain in the illness process. There's a fear of suffering physical pain. There's a fear of suffering pain at the time of death. That's understandable. But there's another, and I would say maybe deeper fear that we don't usually acknowledge, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And this is the fear of the mind stream ending, of the flow of sense experience and consciousness coming to an end. Do you remember when Carol gave the talk on the Second Noble Truth, the 3 kinds of craving that are alive in us? There's a craving for sense pleasures. The second one is the craving for existence. The third is the craving for non-existence. This craving for existence doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it? What would be the big deal if this stream of consciousness ended? I mean, suppose I went to sleep tonight and I didn't wake up in the morning. That would not be a problem for me. It might be a problem for a lot of other people, but that wouldn't be a problem for me. I wouldn't be there to feel it. And yet we have this dread of the stream of continuity coming to an end, and that's because of this force of bhava tanha, the desire, the craving for existence, for becoming. It's not quite rational, but it's very strong. So the Buddha said we only need to fear death if one of four things is present. We're very attached to sense pleasures. We're very attached to the body. We have done a lot of unwholesome actions and not many wholesome actions, and we don't have faith in the Dhamma. But, he said, if these 4 things aren't true, we don't need to fear death. So if we're not overly attached to sense pleasures, not overly attached to the body, have done lots of wholesome actions, and we have faith in the Dhamma, we don't need to fear death. So this is a high bar, but it's a doable bar. And for me, I've been very inspired my whole practice career by accounts of beings whose practice led them to overcome the fear of death. I thought that would be a marvelous outcome to living if one could die unafraid. And the Buddha said that's possible. That's possible for us. We have a fear of particular events. I mean, this is kind of the generic fear, right? Something's going to happen in the future and we're afraid of it happening because it could be unpleasant. The Dalai Lama had a very wise thing to say about this. He said, there's no reason to worry about things. One of two things is true. Either you can do something about it, in which case you should do it, and then you don't need to worry. Or you can't do anything about it, so you shouldn't worry anyway. It's true, isn't it? Very reasonable. That's a good one to reflect on. It doesn't really help to worry. There's also in our practice a fear around meeting an edge of what's familiar to us. You know, in our practice, we're opening bigger and bigger spaces, more and more range of experience. And as we touch some of these new kinds of experience, we're touching parts of heart, mind, body, and also the transpersonal that aren't so familiar. So when we hit one of these new places, fear often comes up as I don't know what to do here. Is this safe? I'm not quite sure about this. So, for instance, touching a place of calm can be a little unsettling because it's hard to locate the usual sense of self, you know, through our thought activity. Touching a place where thoughts stop can be unsettling because we start to feel disoriented, like, where am I if my thoughts aren't defining me, if they aren't making me? Or we just feel so open at times that we feel very vulnerable. You know, anything could come, we recognize that. Anything could come and we feel vulnerable with that. When we start to see into the three characteristics, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no continuing self, those insights can be unsettling because they really lead us into seeing the groundless nature of existence. The lack of solid place to plant anything starts to become clear, and that's not so easy to take right away. We could say opening to this groundlessness has an unsettling potential to it. So the Tibetans talk about that it takes some time to learn to bear emptiness. Or you could say groundlessness. Or you could say not self. And so this is true. It may feel uncomfortable, may feel scary at first. The good thing is that those experiences of emptiness, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self are very trustworthy experiences. Just like calm and the absence of thought. But we haven't learned that yet. So we need to trust in the words of the Buddha, trust in the message of the Dharma, and just tell ourselves to relax and open to that new way of seeing. It's the most trustworthy place. It opens us up to not holding on, and non-clinging is the greatest security available to us. So these insights are trustworthy. The places they lead to can be open to. And as we trust, we learn to settle there with a great sense of faith and confidence. So whatever the source of the fear might be, all these different areas and more that I haven't talked about, the way we work is pretty much the same. And when I talk about how to work, I hope you'll see how this part of the talk can also apply to all the afflictive emotions. Whether it's desire, or shame, or anger, or sadness, or self-judgment, the same basic movement is what's needed in all of them, and the same potential for opening and freedom in relation to them is the same. Tonight I'm just going to be talking about fear, but it applies to all of them. So the most important thing, and I think you all probably know this, in relating with fear is that we need to face it directly and feel it if it's present. We need to meet it, and it's only through the meeting of it that we will find freedom in relation. We can't find freedom tucked under our covers reading a book about how fear works when we're feeling quite cozy and sipping our chamomile tea. We have to find that freedom from fear in the very middle of experiencing it. So for this reason, when fear comes in the middle of a meditation retreat, it's a great opportunity, because now we have the chance right in the moment to learn and grow our wisdom. This has been used by teachers in very direct ways. Ajahn Mun, who's one of the great teachers in the Thai forest tradition of the last 100 years, very fierce teacher, would send his monks way out in the forest to meditate where tigers had been heard. If tigers had been roaring in the forest nearby, Ajahn Mun would say, good, you go sit there and hope that you get to hear a tiger roar near you. Because he saw that that was an occasion that might bring up a little bit of fear. And that would give the monk the chance to really work with it. He also liked to send people out to sit in graveyards. Ajahn Chah relates an experience sitting in a graveyard where a lot of fear came up for him, and he learned a lot from it. So what we need to do is meet the fear and learn about it. It's really the understanding of the nature of fear that releases its grip on us, that lets us come to equanimity with it. So first we think we're going to get rid of the fear, but we start to understand that we can't get rid of it without really opening to it with a lot of acceptance. That's what brings the understanding. So what's our first reaction when fear arises generally? My reaction was more fear. I thought, I don't want to be feeling this. This shouldn't be happening. I don't know how to be with this. How do I get away from this as quickly as possible? And then the fear would engender more fear, and that fear would engender more fear. And this is the origin of a panic attack, where the fear just builds and builds and builds on itself in a big feedback loop. So I want to mention a monk in the Tibetan order. If you haven't heard of him, he's a wonderful teacher and yogi named Mingyur Rinpoche. He's a young Tibetan Lama. And interestingly, someone has brought him into the room by putting a picture of him on the back altar. And it's a very beautiful photo. So I'll get to it later. Mingyur Rinpoche was the son of a great meditation teacher named Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche, and was very interested in meditation from the time he was a boy. And his father gave him some instructions, and he would go off in caves and sit down and pretend to meditate, even though he didn't quite know what he was doing. It was like, you know, when we play doctors or nurses or something. He was playing monk in the cave as a young boy, because that's really what called him. So when he grew to be 13 years old, he heard that there was a 3-year retreat in a monastery nearby. He asked his father and the teacher for permission to attend, and it was granted. So he undertook his first 3-year retreat at age 13. And this is a little bit of his account. He discovered when he first started to meditate that he had a lot of fear. And he thought that going into meditation might help with that. I'd like to say that everything got better once I was safely settled among the other participants in the 3-year retreat. On the contrary, however, my first year in retreat was one of the worst of my life. All the symptoms of anxiety I'd ever experienced, physical tension, tightness in the throat, dizziness, and waves of panic that were especially intense during group practice, attacked in full force. Completely cut off from the distractions of everyday life, I found myself in the position of having to directly confront my own mind, which at that point was not a very pleasant bit of scenery to stare at day after day. But the beautiful thing is that he had the confidence to go in and meet his fear and work with it day after day, and his dedication to the meditation really resolved that problem of panic for him. And then his mind opened up in very beautiful ways. So for me, he's one of the most inspiring young Tibetan teachers that I know of. He has a lot of students in the U.S., a lot of students in Asia. And about 3 years ago, he announced he was leaving them all to go into a 3-year retreat. because his call to practice was so strong. So he did that. One morning, about 3 years ago, he slipped out of his room without telling anyone, didn't take money, apparently didn't take his passport. He was in Bodh Gaya at the time, and he disappeared. Nobody knew where he was, including his mother. And then earlier this year, one of his friends and students ran into him in Kathmandu, surprised to see him, it wasn't planned, and was able to travel with him for a little bit. And he had been spending the years just wandering on his own through the Himalayas, meditating in caves, begging for food, sometimes receiving it, sometimes not, but devoting himself to meditation out in the wild parts of the Himalayas. So the photo of Bingyur Rinpoche that's on the back altar is, it's on the front left. So as you look at the Kuan Yin, go to the front left from there, you'll see this photo. He's kind of opened up in this pose that looks a little bit like surrender, and there's such a joyous expression on his face. And that's the evolution of the panic attack when met with real mindfulness and awareness. You get this sense of great release from that photo. That's Bingyur Rinpoche. So how do we work? We want to open to the feelings as best we can. When I started working with my fear, the place I was told to go first, the place I focused on for a long time, was body sensations. So similar to Bingyur Rinpoche's description, when fear was present, I would look in the body and see what are the sensations connected with the fear. And I would feel this sense of shakiness. I would feel kind of a fluttering in my stomach. My heartbeat was speeded up. My breath was really shallow. And there was a kind of, there was both a tightness in my body, a contraction, but there was also a sense of being very light, not solid and not grounded. Those were the sensations that I had to get familiar with. They were really unpleasant, especially because I was feeling fearful at the same time. But the instruction was, come to feel those sensations and as far as possible, open with full acceptance of them. So little by little, touching them time and time and time again, that's what I tried to do. And I got better at it. So I found that I didn't like them, but I found that I could bear them. So I got to the point where I saw, okay, I can bear these sensations, and I'm going to come out of this experience, and they won't have really harmed me. So I got it. I can bear the sensations of the fear. The next place I wanted to look was that mind state. And we've talked before about how an emotion has a physical expression, but its basic nature is mental. So I wanted to look for that mood or flavor of fear in the mind. Every emotion has its own flavor. Happiness has a different flavor than sadness, has a different flavor than anger, a different flavor than compassion, and so on. So I wanted to bring my attention close to that flavor of fear that was in the mind. But that turned out to be really difficult, because the nature of fear is to flee. So as I tried to get the attention close to the experience of fear, it would kind of bounce off because the nature of fear was fleeing. So it was very hard, actually, much harder than with sadness, say, to bring the awareness close to the experience of fear as a mood, as a flavor. But I was eventually able to do it. And it's very unsettling. That wanting to flee bit is not fun. But eventually I was able to bring the awareness there, feel it, and more to find I could bear that also. I could taste that mood directly, and I could learn to bear it. And I saw it also wasn't harming me. And then I looked at the third aspect of the emotion, which are the thoughts that accompanied the fear. And of course, when you're in a fearful state of mind, you think fearful thoughts, right? That's just part of the territory. You think about what's going to go wrong, what could happen to me, what could harm me, and so on. When you're in a loving state of mind, you think loving thoughts. When you're in an angry state of mind, you think angry thoughts. When you're in a compassionate state of mind, you think compassionate thoughts. In a fearful state of mind, we think fearful thoughts. So I was aware that that projection into the future was going on, and that continued to feed into the fear. And so I worked to accept all of those, and I brought greater and greater trust that I could bear those experiences, and I'd come out the other side. And I came out the other side enough, because the fear would arise for a while, and then it did pass. I'd come out the other side enough that I could see that it really hadn't hurt me. It hadn't left any lasting harm in my body or in my mind. Contracted for a while, painful for a while, but it went through. And what I saw was, oh my God, it's just another emotion. Fear comes with this charge, like there's this belief that's embedded in it, something bad is about to happen. That's sort of the underlying belief that fear brings to us. Watch out. You're in danger. Something bad is about to happen. And every time fear comes, if we're not really mindful, we'll pick up on that message. So I'd been sitting with it and still afraid while I was in it, something bad's going to happen. But every time I came out the other side and nothing bad had happened. And then I saw that belief isn't true. It's just another emotion. And then I saw it's just a cloud, that it comes and it settles in for a while, it makes us feel a certain way, it makes us think a certain way, then it passes through. So it's just another element of the weather. And it doesn't mean that anything bad is anywhere near happening. So when I really started to see that, that's what I call seeing the emptiness of it. There's nothing more to it. We don't have to give extra meaning. Like usually we give the meaning, oh, it means something bad's going to happen. That's not true. It's just an emotion. So being with the simplicity of the emotion, I found I could start to accommodate that. I could allow that within my experience, and my awareness was bigger than that. So I found the awareness could accommodate that. But I still didn't like it. So then Joseph, who was one of my teachers at the time, put this out in a Dharma talk. He said, you know, if you are really accepting of a mind state like fear, it would be okay with you if you were with it for the rest of your life. So I said, well, let me try that on. So next sitting, fear was coming up, and I said, would it be okay if this lasted the rest of my life? And the answer was very clear. No way. Absolutely not. So I saw there was a level of non-acceptance still in my relationship to it. So I was curious. I thought, well, why wouldn't that be okay? And I thought, well, if I'm in a state of fear, I'd had certain experiences in my life that sort of came out of that loving space that wouldn't be available to me anymore. I wouldn't be able to fall in love with somebody from a place of fear. I wouldn't be able to open to a sunset, you know, with that sense of merging if I was full of fear. I wouldn't be able to listen to music and have that, you know, sense of delight and being one with the music. Those experiences wouldn't be available to me, so I wasn't willing to really open to the fear. So I continued, but having brought the question up, I saw I was in conflict. I was still in conflict with the fear. So I would feel that conflict. I'm still resisting it. I'm holding back. I'm not really letting it all the way in. And I thought, do I want to go on in this state of conflict? I didn't, because it didn't feel good. And then I thought, well, do I want to live in conflict, or do I want to hold out for some future possibility of gratification that may or may not ever happen again? I said, I don't think I want to live in conflict. So I dropped the resistance, and I just said, okay, if this is here for the rest of my life, that's okay with me. And there was something about that movement of complete acceptance that kind of broke the spell of fear. It's like it took all the wind out of its sails. that degree of complete openness and complete okayness with it, it didn't have anything to fight against anymore. And so it, at that moment, it kind of crumpled. That's not to say it didn't come again and I had to go through the reflection again. But at that period in my practice, when I was working with it a lot, I had a complete equanimity about whether fear was there or not. I really didn't care if it arose or if it didn't arise. Either one was perfectly fine with me. And that resolved something about my relationship to fear. So it reduced a lot over the years. It's not a big force for me now. It's not to say it couldn't become again. It's, you know, it's still kind of a tendency of my mind. When my mind goes off balance, that's the direction it goes in, because that's the deeply worn groove. So, but these days it shows up more as anxiety or worry. But there's a way that I know that if fear comes strongly, I know how to relate to it. I know how to open to it. And I don't feel a fear of fear now. So I think it's possible to reach this level of acceptance and equanimity with any of the emotions that are strong for us. And when we do, we find it really takes the power out. They lose the ability to cast that spell over our heart and mind. And so this big space opens up where that knot used to be. You could call it peace. You could call it acceptance. You could call it love. You could call it spaciousness. You could call it equanimity. The experience is that one's mind has been released from something which was holding it very tightly in its grip. And there's just more ease, acceptance, allowance of the whole experience of living. So I want to close with a quotation from Mingyur Rinpoche, which is also on the back table. And remember that this is someone who really struggled with the experience of fear as a young teenager, age 13, 14. And I think you'll get a sense of how free his mind is now. So this is what he said. He was met in the middle of his wanderings, 3 years of wandering. He was met unexpectedly by a friend and student and who traveled around with him, took the photo that you'll see in the back, and then Mingyur Rinpoche wrote a letter that the friend brought back to civilization and has shared. So that letter is up on Mingyur Rinpoche's website. And I'll just read this short excerpt. And he talked about, in the letter he wrote, how in his wanderings there had been times when he wasn't given food. He was high up in the mountains, and he didn't have warm clothes or a sleeping bag. And so he talked about being hungry, being cold, being tired, being wet, and other times that, you know, the essentials were provided for him. So this is the quote. "While I have experienced both happiness and suffering, the most important thing is that a deep and heartfelt sense of certainty has arisen in the depths of my being, such that no matter what happens, I know that the true nature of all these experiences, their very essence, is that of timeless awareness and vast compassion." So let's just sit for a minute together, please. While I have experienced both happiness and suffering, I know that the true nature of these experiences, their very essence, is that of timeless awareness and vast compassion.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.